Hey folks, this is Scott Weingarten, and this is an MCrit Wee. We're on the phone with Sean Townsend, and he is kind enough to take time out of his transit to Qatar to talk to us about the Surviving Sepsis campaign and the NQF sepsis measure. Sean, why don't you say hello to the listeners?
Hi everybody, nice to have an opportunity to talk to everybody about the recent changes with after the process trial and NQF's updates to the process measures.
Now, Sean, you're a critical care doc, you're a quality assurance maven, and what is your role on the Surviving Sepsis campaign?
I'm a member of the Surviving Sepsis campaign steering committee. I've been involved with the SSC since 2005, so it's been a long history now, almost 10 years.
And now you were part of the NQF measure as well. I think you were one of the people promoting and offering the initial measure to the NQF. Is that true?
Yeah, you know, it started with Manny Rivers back in 2008, and we helped him the first time around. He didn't get a measure approved. It came up for reconsideration, and he was looking to get it approved again. And one of the key things for NQF is you need a lot of data to support a variety of elements of the measures, and the campaign had that. So we teamed up with Manny in 2012 and got the first set of measures for sepsis passed in 2013.
Now, of interest, and you know, I didn't believe they would do it. NQF, you know, they had this measure newly created, approved, and they said if more evidence came out, we would reevaluate and consider altering the measure. And I just thought they were blowing us off. But on Tuesday, they did alter the measure, and they took out CVP and central venous oxygen saturation checking from the NQF measure. What's your take on that?
Yeah, they did. And I actually knew that they, true to their word, that they would do that. I had a good feeling that that was the case. I wish that it hadn't happened as fast as it did. I wanted to see the full suite of three trials come out on early goal-directed therapy, all three process, ARISE, and PROMISE. And PROMISE and ARISE are foreign trials. They're still pending. But my thought process generally was, let's not do anything until we see all three, because then we'll have a full evidence base.
And that's fair. And my personal feeling is NQF made a very good choice because process, to my mind, was just the final nail in the coffin, especially for something like CVP, but probably for SCVO2 monitoring as well. This wasn't an unexpected result for a lot of us in the sepsis community to see that those two particular aspects were not contributing to the amazing mortality reduction that's come around from the change in sepsis care. But Surviving Sepsis is still saying we should be doing those things. Is that correct?
Yeah, and so I guess, Scott, that gets to the point of do you think process is definitive, and what does definitive mean? And so a couple broad brushstrokes there would be the conclusions of process is that early goal-directed therapy is not inferior to either protocolized standard care or usual care, the arms of the trial. Not that it harms people or is an ineffective strategy. And I would say that really process seems to be a trial of quantitative resuscitation versus quantitative resuscitation versus quantitative resuscitation. And so my feeling is that the trial really compared some very aggressive strategies in all three arms.
Which I don't disagree with, but why aren't we given the option to choose any of those three aggressive strategies?
Well, the perspective the campaign brought to the table, and I think there's a lot of signal here, is that process was done in 31 academic centers across the country. The type of resuscitation that even in usual care you would receive, or the type of resuscitation you get in protocolized standard care with Q30-minute checks by a physician, is unlikely to represent the standard of care that you're going to get in the 4,500 community hospitals across the country. So while there are 500 academic centers, the vast majority of centers are community facilities where a hospitalist receives you from the emergency department with or without a line. You're admitted to an ICU where there is no intensivist, and then you're cared for in between that hospitalist's admissions and discharges, presuming that you get a hospitalist. You may get a community physician who's admitting that night from home.
But that's making the assumption that same scenario would be augmented by now telling that non-hospitalist treating doc that he also has to place a central line, measure CBP, and send SCVO2s.
Yeah, it is. It's basically saying that protocols apply to community hospitals to a far greater extent than they do to academic facilities. And so we view process as having a problem with generalizability to the vast majority of hospitals across the country.
If you guys had mandated the hybrid arm, the protocolized care, you'd still have a protocol that you could offer these community hospitals. They'd still have to follow a set of guidelines, and they probably would achieve the same mortality benefit if we believe in the internal validity of the process trial.
If you could execute that protocol with the type of reliability that was done in the process trial. So Q30-minute checks and appropriate handoffs between critical care staff and nurses were mandatory, which, again, it's not clear they fit the community setting. And one of the reasons we wanted to see a rise in promises, it's kind of interesting. If you look at the harmonization paper, all these three trials will be published as a meta-analysis eventually. So the intention of the investigators has always been to combine them. But if you look at the harmonization paper they published in Intensive Care Medicine in 2013, they under centers on page 1768, they're very explicit to say, you know, U.S. hospitals are academic facilities. This is a threat to generalization of our results. But in Europe and Australia, the regional centers that are non-academic have been key contributors to some of the work. And they actually go so far as to say it will extend the generalizability of the results. And I think that's probably true. Even these regional centers may be more advanced than many of our community hospitals. But it would be nice to see all those results come together. I guess the only other point I should make, Scott, here is before I sound as if we're too adamant, the campaign is fully prepared, and I would hope you take this as a promise that's stronger than the one that the NQF made, and you actually have some faith in it. We're going to make a decision at some point based upon these trials, how to move forward. And if they're all negative, we're not crazy people. It'll turn out that we provide people more choices and options.
All right, that's a very fair statement, sir. And so let's leave off on the reasons you're holding off waiting for these other two trials, because I think that is, it's a reasonable argument. Alan Jones would say that none of these other two trials apply more to America than the American trial, and that's a fair point as well. But I understand where you guys are coming from that perspective. But the other statement you made about process being non-applicable due to the mortality differences, I found that to be very confusing, being that most of us looked at the original Rivers trial at the mortality numbers and said this is very discordant from what we're seeing in the rest of the country. And yet it seems like Surviving Sepsis is saying process is the outlier. Could you expand on that, sir?
Yeah, I think that your observation about Rivers is it raised an eyebrow for me as well when I first looked at the paper and saw a 46.5% mortality rate in the control arm in that group. And it may have been high, it may have been a high spectrum, I'm not sure. One of the interesting things that I've seen is Manny's kept track of the meta-analysis of all trials that tested early goal-directed therapy versus other forms of care. And I want to make sure I cite these numbers correctly, but this meta-analysis, including process, shows that the mortality rate prior to doing early goal-directed therapy is always in the 30% range. And then after early goal-directed therapies is somewhere in the low 20s. If you look at the two, if you break this into two arms in a meta-analysis. So that seems to square pretty well with my understanding of what community hospitals do. I've worked at Sutter Health. We have 26 community hospitals. We measure and follow our shock mortality rates. I can tell you that our highest shock mortality in our system is 50%, but admittedly that's a critical access facility. And our lowest shock mortality is 22, but the average is 33. And that's what I've seen to be typical in community facilities.
Now, we have our New York City collaborative that I think we've talked about in the past, where we have 60 hospitals. A bunch of them are community centers. After implementing a protocol that didn't involve central access unless the patient needed vasopressors have a 22% mortality in our 15,000 patients, which would, I think, jibe quite nicely with the process results. And that's a big community portion filling up those 15,000 patients. Would it be a valid argument to say that if you just initiate any protocol that involves caring about these patients, you probably achieve similar mortality reduction?
I don't know, Scott. I've looked at the Greater New York Hospital Association data in the past. I know that it's not yet published. I know that there are a lot of choices that are allowed. I know that about half of the patients who had alternate methods of volume assessment had empiric fluid loading, which is ill-defined as far as I can tell. I don't know what those results mean. I've had trouble interpreting them. I believe, as a general principle, I think that the thrust of your question, I believe that protocolized care and applying standards to care will lower mortality versus just doing whatever happens next in the hospital in a random sort of fashion.
I think that's a very deft answer to that question, so I applaud you for that.
Hey folks, Emcrit popping in here out of frame for a second. We've talked about the New York City Collaborative data. It actually is published in abstract form. It's out there. The final manuscript is being worked on right now, and there's a lot you could say is wrong with the data. I mean, how much fluid did the patients receive? We don't know. But the number that is ironclad, the number that can't be argued with because it's the one number that we have real assurance as to the validity, is the mortality data. We know the entry criteria is the same as process. We know the mortality at the end of the collaborative. It's not arguable. If you have put people through a protocol similar to the one we did, they're going to get around 20% mortality. So that is the number we should be working with as a baseline for a large number of community and academic centers. How they got there? Can't tell you for sure, but that's where you will get if you do something similar to the New York City Collaborative. And that's without things like CVP or SCVO2. And that really, you just can't argue with. That is the number we should be dealing with and not 46%, not even 30% that we saw in the original Rivers trial. All right, enough popping in.
The last thing I guess we should talk about is something that's always puzzled me is why not adopt Alan Jones' lactate quantitative resuscitation?
Yeah, no, I think the campaign has, actually. If you look at the new bundles, right, the first element is to check serum lactate, and the last element is, if it was elevated, to repeat it. So the intention there was essentially to get people to start doing serial lactate collection. And that's preserved after the changes that NQF made to those measures. So that's good, and I think there was a lot of belief that lactate clearance, in addition to other parameters, is always a signal that you're getting to closer to better resuscitation. The only caveat I have here is that there's good literature that says up to 50% of patients with severe sepsis and septic shock won't present with elevated lactates. So the trouble there, of course, is, 10% of zero at 2 hours is still zero, and difficult to know whether you're helping a patient in that case.
Well, though we could also quote literature directly derived from Jones and literature from other groups saying that those patients who don't have the elevated lactate seem to do quite well regardless of what you do, that it may be a different form of shock. I believe even Manny has alluded to that. Is that not been your thinking as well?
No, I think a subset of them may do well, but I mean, if you think about the patients who are, you remember that nice two-dimensional bar graph in intensive care medicine showing, I think it was published, my column might have been involved with it, I'm not quite sure at the moment, but it was nice data showing that if you're hypotensive, your mortality rates are as high as elevated shock, or elevated lactate levels. Hypotension, I guess what I'm trying to say is, as a marker, if you're hypotensive without an elevated lactate, you're still in a bit of trouble.
Hey folks, Emcrit popping in here again. I did a pretty extensive literature search on this, and at some point I'll put up a post. Hypotension without an elevated lactate does not seem to portend as bad an outcome as elevated lactate and hypotension and elevated lactate without hypotension. And I'll put all that literature up in the next couple weeks.
if a hospital came to the Surviving Sepsis campaign, or you personally, maybe a hospital in your group, and said, look, here's what we're going to do. We're going to protocolize. We're going to give early antibiotics. We're going to admit these patients, once we've identified them as severe sepsis, to a monitored setting where they're going to get good, careful care. We're going to give approximately 4 liters of fluid, and we're going to watch them. Would you say that hospital is not providing good care in 2014 based on the current evidence base?
Well, Scott, let me flip the question around. You're an intensivist, critical care physician, an ED physician. You're traveling to a conference, and you're in the middle of Virginia, and suddenly you become severely septic. You're falling into shock. By the time you get to the hospital, you're 70 over 40, you have a heart rate of 120. The good news is you look up, and I'm standing at the bedside, and I said, well, Scott, I can help you here today. I've got a couple choices for you. You can have our protocol of hemodynamic targets includes measuring your CDP and your SCDO2 and making sure your urine output is adequate and come to our ICU. Or you can have usual care. What would you like?
I'd like you caring for me and doing what your clinical judgment tells you to do. And I think I'd be just fine with that if you never stuck a central line. And I'd be quite happy to be in your hands and you using your clinical judgment to determine what I need next. If you gave me the 4 liters of fluid and the early antibiotics, I'm thinking I'm pretty much 99% there.
Well, I'll tell you, I'll take the line and I'll come to the ICU. And I don't know if you get me if you go to the floor after you get 4 liters of saline. So,
All right, sir. I don't want to keep you any longer. What would be the last thing you want to leave the listeners with?
I want to leave everybody with the impression that the campaign is critically evaluating the literature. We publish our guidelines every 4 years, and it'll be nice to have a full set of papers out. And it's the wave of the future is clearly more experimentation and other strategies. We just need to figure out a way to bring community hospitals into compliance with the control arm process. 60% of patients in process had Lyme's, mortality rates of 18.9%. Those things aren't typical of our community hospitals. And until we can get there, I don't think that we can compare ourselves to the control arm.
All right, sir. I'm not going to keep you any longer. This was wonderful. I know the listeners will love to hear this, and you might get some comments on the page, and I hope if you get a chance after Qatar, you check in and maybe respond to some of them.
I love you. Thanks for the interviewing me. I appreciate it, and it's always a changing world in sepsis care, and it's never a dull moment. So thanks a lot, Scott.
Have a great trip, sir, and we'll be in touch.
Take care.